All right, welcome to class. Our last session. Today we're going to talk about skin and leaves and stuff. And then, you know, that probably won't take the whole time, so we may have a little time to talk about anything else you want to talk about at the end, and then we'll be done. Just as a reminder, I will probably be a little late in getting the quiz out. I realize, though, that I'll be in a hotel tomorrow night, so I'll have plenty of time to write a quiz. So it probably won't be that late. But it won't be tonight, I believe. Yeah, before we dive in, though, thoughts, comments, questions, concerns, other things for me. Yes? Yeah, so I believe that I'm going to, unless there's something going wrong with your life that you tell me about and I agree, it should be due at the end of classes. I won't be here Friday to check, so practically that probably means Monday, but before finals begin. And if that is a hardship, let me understand why. Yeah?
But if you're submitting revisions to old homeworks and projects, still.
Likewise, yeah. I've been very like, you can do things whenever, during the semester. And then the semester's ending, and so that's over. Other questions? Yeah?
Why, you mentioned the rounding error tends to be high for this kind of thing on homework 5.
Yeah.
Do you know why it tends to be high?
Yeah. It's not high for every type of thing that's going on, but it's high for some types of things. In particular, think about hue. Hue is usually the one that has the biggest rounding error. Why would hue have a large rounding error? Right, let's consider the difference in hue between 255, 255, 254, and 254, 255, 255. These differ by 2 bits, but their hue differs by 1/3, right? So as things get close to white or close to black or close to gray, the hue becomes very fragile. And so in particular, hue tends to have this problem. Value and lightness are much more robustly defined. It's not very not very ambiguous what they are, but saturation as well, right? These are just sort of differences of things. We can determine those with fair confidence. But hue is only defined when things are bright, when they're highly saturated. And so if the saturation is low, the hue is poorly defined, which means if you're off by a bit here or there, or the equivalent in floating point, you may be off dramatically in your hue. Because of that, if you were to think about, we have the monochrome hue. If you have different hues where the world is white, okay. If you have different hues where the world is blue or brown, not okay, right? They'll be off by a few pixels because even there, it's not super saturate, right? The planets are not densely saturate. And then similarly, if you then go to equalize hue, this particular image is fairly unambiguous, but what is the white's hue? And so if, depending on what you think the white's hue is, you could end up with different values. So, you know, there are things particularly with hue that make this uncertain. Other questions? Or did you want me to talk about channels other than hue?
No, that's fine.
Okay. I should comment, it doesn't really matter what, I've now seen 3 of these images. If we think about the hue circle, let's say this is hue 0 and it's also hue 1 and it's red. Okay, and so then we go over here to green and here we have blue. Okay, and so we think about the original logo, let's go to the original logo because I only have pictures of the modified one. The original logo, it has some blue with a little bit of green. So we've got some hues there. And we've got some orange, which is red with a little bit of green. So we've got some hues there. If these don't either stay put or move closer to the extremes, you didn't equalize hue. Right? So if you find somehow this is getting greener, you're doing something wrong. It doesn't really matter what hue you thought white was. you can't move them together and say you're equalizing, because equalize spreads things out. Anyway, so there are some things, even when they're ill-defined, there are things that could happen and things that couldn't. Anything else before we talk about leaves and skin and stuff? Okay. Hopefully this will work. Nope, that's the person. The Fresnel equations. That's what we want. All right. Every once in a while, the nice clean truth we tell you isn't true. So this is the kind of picture that you have when you're dealing in fields with waves and you wish you didn't. And this is a picture of something called the Fresnel equations. The Fresnel equations dictate how as a wave is propagating along and it hits certain kinds of barriers, some of it transmits and some of it reflects. Okay. We haven't mentioned this before. We have mentioned about transmission and reflection. But Fresnel's equations turn out to apply any time the pace of the wave would be different on the different sides. If it moved faster here than there, you'll get this Fresnel partial reflection, partial transmission. What is an example of something where light moves faster on one side than the other? Refraction. Right? All of those things. Now, when we talked about refraction, we just completely ignored this. We said all the light goes through Snell's law, hooray! That was false. Okay? Because really, we have Fresnel. And actually, it gets more complicated than Fresnel because its boundary isn't uniform and the material inside isn't uniform and the, right? And I mentioned this on the very last day of class, about a month and a half after we talked about refraction the first time, in part to point out that we deal in abstractions in visualization. In computing generally, we often just care about enough to get the job done. And so often you can say, I don't really care about how Fresnel works. I'm just going to make something that's mostly refractive and partly reflective, and everybody will say it looks fine. But every once in a while, that turns out not to be true. And one of the examples of where that turns out not to be true is like every material that isn't metal in the world. Okay, so metals are just about the only thing in the world. There are a handful of exceptions, but basically metals are the only ones where light bounces off the surface. For just about everything else, what happens is that we have light coming in, and it does arbitrary stuff inside, and then it comes out somewhere nearby. This is true of everything organic. So all animal parts, all plant parts. It's true of waxes and plastics and on and on. Almost everything we ever actually want to make a picture of, this is true of. It's true of paint. It's true of everything. And we mentioned this in passing, and then we just sort of moved on and said, but we'll do this BRDF. BRDF doesn't work here. There is no reflection that would get you out the other side there. And so there's these more general things. There's this thing called the BSDF, the bidirectional scattering distribution function. And then there is the BSSDF, the bidirectional subsurface scattering distribution function. And there's the BTDF, the bidirectional transmission distribution function, and so on. And sometimes you'll even see people talk about the BXDF for the bidirectional something distribution functions, right? Anyway, and if we really study light, we really care about all of these. But we've basically not mentioned them. And the reason we have basically not mentioned them is that many times we can get away with pretending light never entered the object. Because when you think about, for example, this tabletop in front of me, the light goes so far, little distance inside before it pops out again, it didn't matter, right? And some things do shine, okay? Because when it enters Fresnel. which means some of it enters and some of it bounces off. And so when we think about some of those microfacet models, we talked about reflection earlier, where we imagine that at a very low level, this is a rough, lots of flat things, and we're just bouncing off, and that's where diffuse light comes from. Because this is going to have a higher index of refraction than air, some portion of the light really will just bounce off directly, and so these microfacet models give a significant part of the appearance of material, even if some light makes it inside. Okay? So we can often get away with ignoring this. But where we can't get away with ignoring this is anything that looks soft. So, here is actually a photograph. We did something like this, I believe, where I shined a laser pointer into my forehead, right? Nobody remembers me doing this? Yeah, a few people do. Okay, good. Right? When light hits the body, it goes right on through. And it comes out somewhere else. This is easier to see when the light's on the far side. It's harder to see when the light's on the near side because so much of it comes back out. Okay? But if light can hit the far side of the finger and come around to the near side, it can also hit the near side of the finger and come out a different part of the near side. And if it does that, this sort of softens all kinds of lighting effects. You're not going to get sharp shadows, crisp shadows. Even if you have very narrow point light sources, your nose isn't going to cast a sharp shadow on your cheek. It is, but the light that hits one part of your cheek will come out a different part of your cheek, and so the boundary will be blurred. Okay? Because the light that hits in the lit part makes it into the shadows. And this creates this different kind of visual effect. That our eyes see as being soft, as being natural, as being non-artificial, as being human in various ways. And so understanding how this works is a big part of how we deal with graphics. Now, in ray tracing, we just do it brute force. Okay, we just shoot light into it and let it bounce around based on whatever the material properties are until it pops out somewhere or gets absorbed. It turns, and then the process we use inside here, we use something we call Monte Carlo simulation. Why do we call it Monte Carlo? Yes?
It's a casino.
It's a casino.
Casinos are based on randomness.
It's a famous old casino. And casinos are based on, well, not real randomness. We don't use quantum physics in them mostly, right? But predictable systems we don't understand that appear random, pseudo-random, like dice, right? And cards and balls spinning around in completely predictable, but completely unpredictable systems. And that's what we use in computers too, right? So what do we do here? We do a Monte Carlo simulation of the light transport, where we just pick a pseudo-random number to decide how far it goes before it bounces, and then a pseudo-random number to decide what direction it bounces. And we do that until it comes out somewhere, and away we go. It's slow, but there are various ways of speeding it up. We don't have to really deal with finding intersections because we're just in the thing. There might be another side to hit, but we can make the process of individual jumps fairly efficient. The main challenge is we have to do a lot of them. And so we can do this, a Monte Carlo simulation of subsurface scattering, but that only works if we want to wait. And so often we don't want to wait that long. We want a decent approximation without that. So we're going to talk about how this works, because without this, we can't render skin, we can't render leaves, we can't render wax or marble or jade or paint, all kinds of things. But particularly, we're going to talk about leaves and skin, because these turn out to be things we want to render a lot of in a lot of kinds of settings. So, yes. All right. Let's start with what we call signal scattering. Signal scattering means we want light to enter the object, bounce once, and come out. Okay? So we're going to have light come into the object. Because the object is denser than air, we're going to see Snell's law at work. We're technically going to see Fresnel's law at work. Okay? But some of it's going to come in, and it's going to bounce off of something sometime, going in some direction, and then it's going to come back out. Okay? And it could bounce off of something at any time, it could, and it could bounce in any direction in general, although there are materials where it's more likely to bounce in one direction or another, but we'll often just assume it's sort of homogeneous. For much of what we'll talk about today, we'll assume homogeneity of the material. Now, if we think about this, for any given point light could have entered, and any given point light could have exited, there is only one place it could have bounced. Because this angle is dictated entirely by Snell's law. And this angle is dictated entirely by Snell's law. So if I know this vector and that vector, there's one bounce point possible. Okay? And because of that, for single scattering, we can work this backwards. Instead of saying the light came in, where did it go out? We can get a distribution function of all of the places light could have come from. And if we know that right here is the edge of a shadow, but there was a whole lot of light coming in over here, we can approximate how likely any of those light rays were. As they all come in, they all go in here, and they all have to bounce off of different things. We can use this sort of fall-off law to figure out where they're all going to come out in my object so that they will all look in my eye. And so for single scattering, it's more work. It's way more work than Lambert's law. But it's something we can solve. And we can sort of do a lot of this work with in advance. These are not nicely behaved functions, but they're smooth. And so we can approximate them with polynomials using Taylor series or Maclaurin series, because you know all that stuff you learned in calculus actually matters in the real world. And then those polynomials just involve a few multiplications and additions, and we can do those on the graphics hardware, and huzzah. But if we have single scattering, we also have more scattering. But this is the first sort of step, is how we think about what's going on. Okay? So before we get to multiple scatterings, questions about single scattering in this sort of abstract I've waved my hands way. Yes?
So if you only do single scattering, does the light look good to humans?
No.
Okay.
However, single scattering actually does matter. In the end, we're going to have sort of a three-term system. We're going to have single scattering, direct reflection, and then many more scatterings. And so the single scattering turns out to be a big enough contribution that if you don't compute it, it looks a little off. Although, little enough off, often we still leave it out. All right, it turns out that multiple scatterings is actually easier. Although we didn't figure that out for a while. Yes?
From the entrance and exit.
Yep.
But you don't have the exit, right?
Correct. So if I'm working backwards, mm-hmm. If I'm rasterizing the scene, right? So I know, okay, I have seen this object at this pixel. I want to know what color it should be. If I know which triangles near me were lit, then I can figure out how much of their light would make it to me, based on how far away they were, what angle they were at, and how thick the material is. This is not a pretty function. It's an ugly integral that is hard to find a closed form solution to, often impossible, but we can figure that out in advance and create a polynomial approximation, because it's a smooth function. It does that pretty well. We'll look briefly at some of the math of that in a little bit. Okay. Single scattering. We've talked about direct reflection already, so now let's talk about multiple scatterings. We could work through the math of two scatterings and three scatterings, and they're not all the same. But it turns out that if we just assume there were a lot of scatterings for an arbitrary number of a lot, okay, so we assume light comes in, and it bounces and bounces and bounces and bounces and bounces and comes out. Okay. If it does a lot of bounces, we get some nice properties. One of the nice properties we get is we no longer care what angle it came in at. We no longer care what angle it went out at. Because there's a lot of bounces, it's equally likely to have ended up somewhere from a lot of bounces. We sort of lost the angle sensitivity partway through. And so this allows us to make this much more homogeneous system, where we just want to know how much light is coming out one place based on how much light came in another place. It allows us to throw away some nuanced details. And so then we have to figure out how this works. So let's just talk briefly about the paper that realized this was actually doable. We knew about subsurface scattering for a long time. We actually made the BRDFs and surface illumination as a simplification of what we knew optically existed. And this paper sort of talks about some of that. And then it wasn't until, I believe this was 91, if memory serves, this paper came out. Does it have a date on it front somewhere here? Nope. Okay. It's been a while, but we figured out, hey, we can make this thing. So here we start by talking about, here's how light actually works. You have to love it when you have a double subscript, a double integral, one over all angles and one over surface area, of functions defined by multiple subscripts, right? Life gets complicated. It starts complicated. You have a figure of selected symbols. It's about half the symbols that are matter in the paper, right? Okay, the math is messy. And it just keeps getting messier as we try to simplify it, okay? And we start introducing all of these different behaviors of radio transport and other, anyway, and on and on and on it goes. But let's note a few odds and ends. As they're going along, we're not going to go through all of this because it's tedious. It mentions the Fresnel formula. This turns out to be really important to understand how light bounces around internally. And we have this function, and then we're like, can't solve this, but don't worry. It's nicely turned into a polynomial. Here it is. Okay, we just used a polynomial approximation. I believe this is neither Taylor nor Schur. I think this is based off of a non-uniform sampling, but that's a side note, right? This works out pretty well, and this new value with the reflective index of refraction of the medium, that's just we just know what that is, right? So they do some push through huge amounts of math, then approximate it down to polynomials, our life becomes fun, and then do it again, and then do it again, until you get down to the diffusion term of the bidirectional subsurface scattering reflection distribution function, right? Anyway, we do all of this work, and then we get to figure three. Figure three is the reason this paper is important. What is figure three saying? They're saying math, and then the multiple scatterings turn out to be the same as two point light sources. A positive point light source inside the object, a negative point light source out in space. Okay? With the same intensity, so that at any distance, they're going to be about the same distance apart, the light will cancel out. But the negative is going to be a little bit farther away than from the surface than the positive, close up, and they have equations for figuring out exactly where to place these for any given point. And so then you can use this to create a pair of point light sources for every location you want to illuminate, and then just use our normal point light source math. It doesn't work perfectly. They've multiple times along the way taken a complicated thing, turned it into a polynomial, thrown away this term because it seemed to be high frequency and didn't matter, okay? But it works really well. It works really well. They note though, okay, but single scattering, we have to care about single scattering specially. That was one of the terms we shouldn't have thrown away, but we can make a good approximation of that too. And so they go through how we make a good approximation about that. And then they say, okay, we needed to figure out what these things were, so how did we measure it? And then they have this. They say, this worked really well. What do we mean by really well? We'll tell you, okay? This says, we put a camera in an object and measured the green points. We use those to fit our mathematical model. That's the black line. Then we got a camera with a wider range and we measured the blue points. Exactly what is going on in the two axes, not hugely important for this particular example, but they actually measured that it continues to extend outside the range. This is the best kind of proof of a model, that it works beyond what you measured, not just within, okay? This works very well. There have been some later models that have shown particularly where it fails, and we may talk about a little bit of that in the next paper just a touch. And so then they say, okay, here we have it, and then they end up with these pictures that are just, if you weren't really into graphics, you wouldn't understand why this picture is like so cool. So let's talk about why this picture is so cool. We need to turn off the lights for this to work. All right. Scattering of laser light in a marble block. The marble block is 40 millimeters wide. Okay, now, this is actually meaningful. When they put you the size, because subsurface scattering depends on how far light goes before it bounces, they actually measured how far light goes in this kind of marble, and then they simply had the right size block, and they have a significant amount of subsurface scattering. The picture on the left is a photograph. The picture on the right is a synthetic rendering. What is different between them? Yeah, the synthetic rendering actually used a cube, and so it doesn't have a beveled edge. Anything else you can see different? Slightly different color. It's not perfect, but we're getting this penetration of light to almost the same level, okay, based on almost this first principles kind of understanding about the material. No texture mapping, no approximations, they're just running this thing. And how are they doing this? At every point, they just have two-point light sources, a negative one outside the object, a positive one inside, adding them together. They're not running thousands of simulations, they're just doing it. Okay? And so this was big. This sort of stayed big. Various people have built off of this since then. But this was the idea. And then they have lots of pictures of marble. And at the end, they say, oh, let's talk about faces. Now, if we start first with their second face, let's turn off the light so this is clearer. This still doesn't look like a real face, right? You don't have to know that this is a computer graphics paper to say that's not a real face, either a whole lot of airbrushing or a computer generated it, right? But compared to this face, okay, this is as good as you can get with a BRDF to get this. Okay, this is the same underlying geometry where they've actually scanned somebody's facial bumps and so on. But if you don't do something special, you end up with these really hard shadows. You can see the little microfacets that are in your skin, which you can't when the light can emerge somewhere slightly different. And so we get this feature that is characteristic of skin. The shine looks bumpy, the illumination doesn't. Because the shine comes right off the surface. And so in the shine, you can tell their skin. But in the background, you've got these sort of reddish shadows because the red light transfers farther through the material than the green and the blue light because it has a longer wavelength. Anyway, right? So this is so much better. So much better, right? And this was seen as one of the contributions that let us imagine we could eventually get past the worst part of the uncanny valley, right? Don't make everybody look like they're made out of plasticine metal, right? Does a lot to make things look more realistic. Okay, so that was this paper. There's a whole lot of interesting things in here. The end result, though, is we can do really cool things by making a pair of light sources. And they give very clear descriptions about where you put the light sources and how to figure out how to make things look like whole milk versus skim milk, and anyway, right? Yeah. Question?
You said the two light sources are the same intensity, right?
Yep.
Is that like relative to their distances? Or?
No. Okay, so let's get the idea of the monopole. Okay? We want this one to glow and this one to anti-glow. We want this one to be closer than that one. But if we think about some point over here, their distances are nearly the same, right? So this will cause a sort of a rapid fall off. How rapid the fall off is depends on how close to being the same distance away they are. And so by adjusting how far this one is away from the object, the farther in you make it, the less appearance of internal reflection there will be. So if it's really close, it'll be a dense material. If it's really far, it'll be a very translucent material. And then how far away this one goes on the other side is based on elements about the light and a few of the Fresnel properties of the material. And so, yes?
Do we think the glow, like going through an object, is the same as it's glowing through air?
No, actually, we only use this pair to illuminate that one spot.
Oh, I see.
So we're not saying it hits anything at all. We are just saying, or I guess, we do it for that one spot, or if the illumination is coming here, but we actually do it for the spot of that is illuminated. Anyway, there's a little bit of nuance about where you make these pair of lights. Yes?
Would this be a really more approximation for very thin objects like pieces of paper?
Yes, so this does not work for thin objects at all. They need to be quite thick. We'll actually see a refinement that will work pretty well for paper, though. Yes?
What is this technique called?
This is called a dipole approach. Because we have the positive light and the negative light, they always come in pairs, just like dipoles in physics. So this is a dipole. Okay, yeah?
So for each point, you'll go and calculate these two things, or do you make like a map of them across the surface?
Yeah, so there's actually several ways of doing this. Often what you do is you make these for the light. So the illuminated part of the object, you make this pair. And then you use that to compute the unilluminated part, how much light it sees. Okay? How to do that's a little bit tricky. And so the Wikipedia article talks about this thing we call depth map-based subsurface scattering, where you use some level of, you run an illumination of what the light can see, and then you render what you can see. And with these two pictures and how far apart they are, you then run the dipoles to combine the two. And so for this, and this is faster. It's still not fast. I have not seen this used in any real-time system, at least not for the whole thing. Occasionally I'll do it for a piece here and there. But it's a whole lot faster than ray tracing. So it does get used. And we'll actually look at a few examples, perhaps, of running it live here in a moment. Other questions before we figure out how we do more complicated objects? OK. Let's go back and look at this hand again. I can't render the hand yet, because I only have two lights. And hands have two surfaces. I have the back surface and the front surface. Okay? Now it turns out that I could say, oh, that was the illuminated side, this is it, and I can use these same pair of lights. And it would work okay if the object was thick enough, but not real well because most of it gets absorbed by the object in between. Okay? This also won't work particularly well if we have a thin slab of things where a significant amount of light, instead of bouncing around and coming back out, bounces around and exits the other side. There's sort of this light loss. This does not deal with the transmission component. The original paper does talk about how to deal with the sort of thick objects and the light on the far side and how it transfers, how you sort of pretend it goes around the surface of the object. But it didn't work as well as they had hoped. And so then there was another paper, just a few years later, that says, what if we have multi-layered translucent materials? And guess what they do? Integrals! Hooray! So, right, we go through those integrals again, and we talk about them more briefly. And they say, okay, their basic final conclusion, they put in figure one instead of figure three. Hooray! They say, this is what we did before. This worked really well, but only if the object was really deep. We can do better than that. Imagine the object is really narrow. We're going to make an infinite sequence of dipoles, which we will call a multipole. Okay? We create the original one using the original paper's technique. And then we mirror it over planes. We mirror it over this plane, but swatch the poles. We mirror it over this, then we mirror that one over this plane. Okay, and you do this forever. And you end up with an infinite series of positive and negative lights adding up. And this will give you the influence of a thin surface. Okay, now, in practice, the ones that are far away don't matter. So you don't have to do the whole infinite series. Although, in what still strikes me as a weird thing, later on when they give their results, where is it here? They say they used 1,000 dipole pairs. Okay, they didn't even try to figure out whether they could stop, because doing 1,000 dipole pairs is still so much faster than Monte Carlo, right? They didn't need to. Okay, so they do that, and then they go through and they say, they basically revisit every part of the other equation and say, but what if? What if the surface was rough? And what if it wasn't a perfect Fresnel and we need a more complicated BRDF? And what if the symbol on one side is different than the other? And how do we combine them? And Fourier transforms for the win. Lots of math, okay? But they end up with the multipole model. And then these various comparisons about how accurate it works, and compare it to the old dipole system. Anyway, they go through it. It goes for a while. But then we end up with, again, the pictures that make this matter. Let's start with the one that just sort of meh, and then we'll get to the ones that are whoa. So we mentioned paper. Here is paper. This one uses the lights on the far side monopole model. It just basically looks dimmer than it should. Not as much light made it through. And we could have solved that as an artist just by making the light brighter. That's an extra thing the artist has to do. Their multipole isn't dimmer. And then here's their Monte Carlo. They actually give the exact percentage of light that flows through in each of the three. Notice this is not a photograph. Okay? They did not do what the first paper did and try to measure the real reflectance properties of objects using cameras and then compare it to that. They basically said, okay, we did that already, and it turned out Monte Carlo works, so we'll just use Monte Carlo, it's easier. Okay. This works because it turns out that parchment is about 4 times the mean transmission depth. So the average distance that light goes through parchment is 1/4 the depth of parchment. And this actually tends to be true of all kinds of papers, because if it gets too much thinner than that, it starts looking translucent, and you can see what's written on the back. And so you change paper, you'll pick a different depth because it has a different amount of scattering, but we sort of stay at that level for most papers, except for certain artist papers like Bristol Board, and anyway, complete aside. So they said, hooray, this works. And then they said, let's do weird things. Let's make a painted jade statue. Okay? Now paint, part of the reason we use paint, just like part of the reason we use paper, is because it's nearly opaque at very thin layers. Jade is very transmissive, but only of green light, which makes it easy to look at. And so they said, all right, we're going to take, this is what the jade model looks like. And it works for their relatively thin pieces, right? This is a better thing for them to do than the previous paper because they can deal with the thin regions better. But then they say we're just going to paint it. And their point was you can tell this is painted jade and not a white object because you can see the green in the edges of the shadows. The light that enters the object and comes back out is green. Okay, and so when you look at it, you can say, ah, that is a painted translucent green thing. And a single static picture, you might not notice it, but this technique has been used in various movies and so on, and you can get across this idea that it's a painted thing, not a solid thing. And then they did this. Now, I'm a little sad that they didn't supply the geometry. They took a leaf. They modeled only the geometry of the leaf, all of its layers. So they did the little surface film, and they did the various chloroforms and the veins. They did all of these, and they modeled their internal reflective systems, put no textures on it, just homogeneous chunks of light. They put lights behind and in front, and they had these pictures. Okay? That have the impact of, you can see that it's ripply, How can you see a triple E? Because your eyes knows what's going on. You've seen enough leaves, you can see what's happening. They have this areas here where one of the layers was missing because it was drying out or the like, and you can say, oh, that looks like the kind of phenomena we see in leaves. And so they have this picture. It's just a picture, but it's a very interesting picture in the sense that it's geometry that looks like a texture. And so it was a significant step forward. And so this is what the sort of things you can do with multipulse. This is a lot harder to implement because you get these multipulse and then you have to combine them with this Fourier system and you can't ignore most of the math like you could for the other one. The other one, you can read through it and you can say, okay, but I just need two lights. How bright are they and where are they located? And you can find that in the paper and you can move forward. And if you get a little off, it looks like the wrong material, but oh well. But this, you then have to say, oh, but I need to know how far apart they are and how they combine and how this Fourier-based joining goes. And so it's considerable more work to make happen. They also have this thing about what if the surface has microfacets, how does that change the transport and sides? They have this smooth and less rough and more rough models. And anyway, they go significant depth into how this works, all without needing to actually transport the light, just using these approximations. And with this, we can now make skin. All right. In case you ever wondered how your skin works, visually, this is how your skin works. I shouldn't have turned on the lights. So, anybody decent at medical Latin? Yeah, me neither. Anyway, apparently we have an epidermis. I think that means the outermost skin, I think. And so I could have that wrong though. Does anybody know?
That's correct.
All right, great. So we have the outermost skin. It reflects almost not at all. It transmits this particular skin. Everybody's skin's a little bit different. This is, I believe it's the epidermis that is where you have your tone and so on. Anyway, but there's some amount that reflects and some amount that transmits, and then they make another layer, the upper dermis. And then there's something called the bloody dermis, where the blood lives. And so it's very red, right? And then they have surface retinous, and they put it all together. Okay? And so here is their resulting picture. Okay? There's no hair. But other than that, this is pretty solid. Right? And so a lot of math to get here, but we end up with something that looks really, really a lot like skin. Enough like skin that if you see this and you notice that must be generated by a computer, it won't be the skin that makes you think that. Right? It'll be the lack of hairs, it'll be how it's moving, it'll be something else. You move past the skin. And to my knowledge, I've tentatively watched this space in the 17 years since this paper came out. I have not noticed a better model for skin. I've not noticed anybody even trying to make a better visual model for skin. This remains, as far as I can tell from reading various sources and so on, this epidermis, upper dermis, bloody dermis, surface roughness, combine them, ta-da, we have skin. Remains how we do it. There has been a little bit of work in can we put a texture map over this, although this paper actually does a tiny bit of that as well, talks about the basis of that. Okay, and then they have the different approaches using different techniques and the comparisons and what happens when you put the light behind the ear. Hooray, it looks like the light behind an ear, just like it should, right? And so they have this system. So we basically, there's still some work potentially to do. There are some things this doesn't capture very well, but it comes really close to capturing a lot of things. And because we have different layers, we could even make a mathematically accurate version of blushing, because blushing happens in the bloody dermis, which gets thicker and more reflective, right? And we can make mathematically accurate models of how you tan and how you burn and so on, because we know where they happen in this model. And if we happen to be missing some layer that really mattered, we could just add it in, because it's just a stack of layers. We can add in the next layer. Yes?
Was the reason that it didn't include hair because hair is difficult?
Or? This paper wasn't about hair.
Yeah, but...
So this... Yeah. It is difficult, but this paper also isn't about hair. It turns out this paper's technique has been used for hair. So there's actually some interesting work that says if you can get the self-shadowing and self-intersecting of hair to work, that's hard by itself. Then it's also translucent, and so you need to use something like a multipole scattering to model the hair itself. And it has layers, and hair is way more complicated than it ought to be for something that's just everywhere. But yeah.
Do you know what kind of model people use to get surface roughness, like the pattern of roughness that looks like skin roughness?
Yeah, 3D scanning.
Okay.
There have been various efforts to try to simulate the growth of skin pores and so on, but I didn't see enough progress there for people to be happy with it before we came up with other techniques. Based on cameras, basically. Other questions? That's also incidentally why this person's eyes are closed. Yeah. Okay. So, with these techniques, we can make things that look real. We can make them quite efficiently. We have Monte Carlo if we really need to. We have quite efficient techniques. Not efficient enough to be real time yet, but no reason why they couldn't eventually be there. So a lot of these images will take, let's say, seconds to run. Let's see. So Blender, I believe, does not have multi-pole built in, but it does have single pole. So let's just add here, let's add a cube. And let's grab it up here a little bit above the space. And I need to zoom out a little bit my camera, sorry. Not like that. Let's change my field of view. All right, so I have this. Okay, so here is a cube. Okay, nothing particularly fancy, hovering a little bit above another cube. I'm now going to come in and I'm going to change the materials of this cube. So I'm going to, so I'm going to make this into, instead of a just diffuse model, I'm going to say, let's give some subsurface scattering to it. And it turns out that this has some of the ones they had in the paper. Let's make this whole milk. Okay, and then for some reason that didn't go, so let me do it again. Oh, what am I missing? What am I missing? I do have the right object selected, don't I? Oh, right, I didn't make it transparent. You can't see that unless it's transparent. So let's give us some transparency here. Nope, that wasn't what I wanted. Sorry, I'm not sure why this, maybe it's just too big. Let's change the scale. I'm not seeing what I expected to see when I did my demo earlier. Oh, there it goes. Okay, so I can make this and I can change the visual scale. So that's if the subsurface scattering goes a long distance and once it finally decides to update, think, that's if it doesn't go as far. Now you can see here quite clearly, well, maybe not quite clearly this light, there are some visual artifacts here, okay? There is this sort of faint line here around the boundary, and that's because I am saying that the mean scattering depth is about that far in. Now, as it can use refine, it will make that better, but around those corners, it's not as good. But notice that this corner, which is completely crisp, does not look crisp. The light manages to make it through. I can then do just weird things to it. I can say, red light should go really, really far through this material. And once it updates, okay, Now notice when I make red light go really, really far, the illuminated sides look green. Because some of the red light that hits the illuminated side has to come out on the other side. Okay, we have this sort of balance, but this all comes out, they just have a positive light and a negative light on each side. And away it runs. Okay, and so we can play around with this however we want. We can say there's no blue subsurface scattering at all, and just turn it off for blue, and we can tweak around the appearance of the material. And it does it quite quickly. Okay, and so we can make things look soft. Now, we could do more complicated things. I'm just trying to show off this works. This doesn't make, right, we notice we still have crisp boundaries here because this is still an actual just cube sitting here. And getting the shadows that this casts to work right and so on is a little bit more complicated. There are more complicated algorithms available, but it works very efficiently. It's only adds, for many of these scenes, if you're going to have decent shadows and a little bit of cross-bouncing, it doesn't add significant time to the rendering. And so you can use it for regular things. It's used in almost every computer animated film I have seen since these papers were published. Often just monopole, because it turns out we like cartoony looking people. But if you look at the skin of any arbitrary CG character, after this came out. Incidentally, Toy Story came out before this paper, so everybody in Toy Story looks like they're made of plastic. But after this came out, right, you start seeing this behavior. So this is how we do skin and leaves. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah?
Can we talk about hair?
Can we talk about air?
Hair.
Sure. I haven't prepared a lot to say about hair. Let's see how much I remember. Yeah. You know what? I'll bet I can find a good picture here that will help this out. Let's look for... That's not close enough. This is up close. But that's not an actual picture. Huh. That's not an actual picture. That's not close enough. Well, that's a hair replacement system. That's not real hair. These are real hairs, but those are ingrown. That's not interesting to look at. That's fake. Okay, maybe I'm not going to find what I want. Conditions that affect your scalp. You know, I never expected this to be one of those things that I shouldn't search for. Maybe we'll just go back to this one and talk at least at the vaguest level about a few things that are going on here. Okay, hair. First off, there is a huge amount of geometry. Okay, doing hair properly is this thing that sort of almost doesn't matter how much space and time you have, you can always make more. Because there's just a lot of hairs, and individual hairs are complicated, right? Because they cast shadows on each other. I actually need to know where they are. And they should never intersect each other. And so I have this huge collision resolution thing, and they stick to each other. That's why they get tangly, and they're shiny, and so on. And they're not all the same color, and they're translucent, okay? But they get worse than that. So let's just talk in the conceptual level. And let's just imagine that your hair was made out of mostly shiny stuff. So let's start with just a cylinder. If I have a shiny cylinder and a point light source, where do I expect the shine? What shape will the shine look to be? Yeah?
A vertical line, like the line on the cylinder closest to the light?
Well, the sign on the cylinder that would reflect to the light.
Right.
Yeah. But it's going to be sort of stretched out along the cylinder and not stretched out the other direction. Or not stretched out nearly as much. Because these points are going to shoot significantly in front or behind the light. But these points are going to shoot almost exactly at it. So we get these stretched out shines along the direction of the hair. Okay? when your hair bends, then you get these things sort of bend around a little bit as round. So at the very bend, we can get dots, and then the straight parts will get stretched out things. And so the shine on each individual hair is complicated. But it's more complicated than this, because I was really hoping we would have, let's see, maybe instead of up close, I could say hair follicle. Nope. Hair microscope. Yeah, these are some. All right. Let's look at this one. This is a decent one. Okay. So, this is a piece of hair. This is a pretty healthy piece of hair, actually. Okay? We have this sort of scaly stuff. That's how we can bend. So those will those fold inside each other almost like the scales of a fish. It's not cylindrical. Okay? Most hair is sort of lumpy or flattish in its cross-section. It tends to be fairly consistent across individuals. And how round it is actually has impact on how curly it is. Cylindrical hair tends to be less curly than flat hair. But that's not a universal thing. There's other things that go into making curl as well. There are considerable papers on how you simulate the curliness of hair. But if we think just about the illumination, we have these little ridges here. Okay. Now this is not visual light. This is, I believe, this looks to me like it's either artificially lit or probably a scanning electronic microscope. When it turns out electrons don't do most of what light does, so you get only diffuse light with scanning electron microscopes. Who knew? Anyway, so we have this behavior here, but we have all these little cross-sectional ridges. They're a little bit lumpy. And so when we are going to simulate a single piece of hair, we sort of simulate it as a tube made out of a whole lot of little tubes. Okay? So these little tubes are going to have the shine spread out this way, but it's going to show out that way across every single one of them. And so we get these sort of shiny shines that spread out in both directions. And so you basically, hair is just really shiny. It doesn't really matter if you thought it was at the right angle to see the light, because you can see the light along one direction, you can see the light along the other direction, hair shines. It just does. Unless, of course, it's very dry, in which case the specular characteristic is very low, right? So the characteristic of hair matters quite a bit. This will actually change significantly with hair products. So depending on what you put in your hair, you can change the surface material texture of the hair. Can cause it to look differently. Anyway, it's more common in people that put enough hair product in their hair to make it just stay put than in other sorts of people. So the visualization of this is very complicated. And then you have to figure out where the hair goes. So there was, I didn't look for this in advance. There was a paper about the way they made the hair for Brave, but I don't remember who wrote that paper. Or, because that was just like how we, all right, let's see. I'm just going to see if I can find it. SIGGRAPH hair. We'll probably find something good this way. So there is this paper, Light Scattering from Human Hair Fibers. Oh, wow, this is a video of the person giving their talk. That's not what we want. How you actually solve it, PICTA. So this is a Pixar post, this is a marketing post, right? But they're saying, how do we do this? How do we make hair? And they have videos here, but this is not gonna have the paper I was hoping for. Anyway, but this does get across some of the concepts that we need to worry about. Hair doesn't behave the nice, like everything falls up in a line. Hair clumps. How does it do this? How do you simulate this clumpiness? And that isn't the same thing as matted hair, because that's hair that you could probably tease apart pretty easily, but you can also have it tangle and it can physically knot, and some hairs can have split ends, and anyway, all of these things have visual effect. And simulating them all is not easy. So there are many papers about this process. In general, nope, that's not what I want. That's a course. Let's see if we have. Real time. Oh, wow. I haven't seen this one before. Let's see if it's any good. I don't think it's going to be. So there are. This is actually a decent paper. I wonder if it will let me in. This is a fairly old one. I don't remember if it has pictures. It may not have pictures, because this is back in like the 80s. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know, right? So this is one of the older papers about hair. And this is, they use what they call three-dimensional textures. And this is actually games. Hair is way too complicated. How do you make hair in games? You make a bunch of ribbons and you put a hair picture on each one. Okay? There are other ways you could do it, but I have yet to, sometimes you don't even bother with that. Sometimes you just make, here is the outer shape of the hair, here's a picture of hair, right? But if you want it to have some ability to flow around and things to go behind it, you make ribbons and you put hair textures, you put several of them behind each other. And this paper is a little bit more involved than that. They have these volumetric textures. So they make these textures that they think that have this sort of this lengthwise varying density, and then they have this texture self-shadowing technique they use here, so that you don't have to measure the individual hairs, you can instead model the hair chunk. And they have various pictures of how this works back in 89. Okay? It works pretty well as long as you don't need any close-ups. It doesn't work so well if you have close-ups for a lot of different reasons, but basically because you don't have a boundary anymore. If things are moving and you can keep them far away, this kind of work can make things work quite well. And this is a recent, this is still 10 years old. This is probably not going to have anything that we want to talk about. Nope, it's not. All right. Nope, I'm not finding it. Sorry. I know sometimes it may sound like I'm making it up as I go in these, but I actually do prepare. And I didn't for this. But often when we're dealing with hair, there's sort of this hierarchical model. So often what we'll do is we'll have models of hair, and then models of groups of hairs, and then models of groups of hairs, to try to deal with the idea of locks. Because hair naturally sort of ends up... Oh, I should have thought of this earlier. Hair naturally tends to end up clustering together in little bunches. And often if you don't do individual little bunches, then it looks sort of, well, there are kinds of hair that move like this, right? So it depends on the texture of your hair. So hair is a complicated thing in that. But if instead you model ringlets, then you don't have as many of them to simulate. And so you just need a model of how the hair moves inside the ringlet and how it moves around that. Oh yeah, super helices. That's often what they call these. That may actually be from the paper I want, although the link doesn't suggest it is. This is actually a decent paper here, although it wasn't the one I was really hoping for, and I don't think they have the PDF here. Oh, there it is. Yeah, all right. So let's see if I remember this paper I read like a dozen years ago. So the idea here, okay, they're going to have this model of springs. Their basic argument here is if your hair isn't straight, it behaves like a spring. And the spring is pulled down by its own weight. So it doesn't go in a nice, simple spiral. It goes in a straight at the top and spiral at the bottom. Okay? And so they're going to use this concept. They have pictures of individual strands. Oh, that's not quite as healthy hair as last one I looked at. Anyway, right? But they actually took photographs of themselves holding hairs and bunching them together to try to talk about how it behaves. It acts like a quite stiff in many ways. Okay? And that gives us some benefit in how we're simulating them. And so they go through and they walk through this and they say, all right, we're going to make this super helical model. We're going to chop it into chunks. Each chunk is going to have a different amount of spin. And we can adjust the spin. We're going to have them related to each other, so all the way straight, to in a tight little curl. And so this will give us an ability to sort of model that kinkiness, helicalness, curliness of hair, whatever you want to call it. Math, math, math. And then they have, I hope I remember this correctly. They have this called the self-interpolating scheme. Okay, so what do? You simulate a few of these, and then you make a bunch of hairs follow a similar path at sort of a close to fixed offset. So here we only have to simulate three of these, then we make a whole lot of other strands follow along with it. You'll notice we have shine, 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 because hair, a lot of cylinders with cylinders going the other way. And so as we handle this, we don't have to simulate all of the strands. We can interpolate a lot of the strands on the other side. They actually have pictures of themselves playing with hair. Right? We're bing, bing, right? And trying to make a mathematical model of what the hair is doing and then seeing if they can do the same thing with their hair, because hair is often all about the motion. If it doesn't swing correctly, it looks wrong. Still pictures are a lot easier, right? And so they took videos of people swinging their heads around and then tried to see if they could make the same kind of thing with their simulation. Not simulating every hair. So you'll see this picture has more consistently sized clumps than this one, because they're just sort of making a handful of guide hairs and then the rest fall along the way. Okay? And so this kind of approach of having these super helices and so on is a technique that has been refined a little bit over the years since then, but still remains a significant part of how we do higher quality hair animation. However, there are so many parameters here, it's easy to get wrong. And so last time I checked, you will still see in CG movies where there's more than trivial hair. In particular, when the same character's hair has to, I don't know, get wet and dry or something like this, you will usually have multiple people who are listed in the credits as just hair. Okay? This is a mixture of artists and technicians, and they are sort of handling this and tweaking the simulation, trying to find exactly the right parameters to get it do what they want it to do. That's my saying is out here. Any other questions you have? All right, well, I've got a few minutes. Let's see if I can make some sort of this all make sense together. I won't be able to, but I'll try. Yep. See, you zoom out, you lose the details. Isn't that like life? What was my goal in this course? I mentioned all this at the beginning, but I don't know that it made sense then. I start off by saying I want you to be conversant in what we do. If somebody talks about graphics, you shouldn't sound like an idiot. Okay? This is one of my goals. I don't want you to sound like idiots. Partly this is because I like you, and partly is because I was your teacher, and I will seem like an idiot by comparison. and so we started with just like, how do things work? How do pipelines work? Build them yourselves, hooray. But graphics is this extremely rich field, because basically what are we interested in? Everything in the real world that involves light. Okay, so if it can be seen or it can impact something you can see, we care about it. And it turns out that if you can't see it and it doesn't impact things we can see, nobody studies it because they don't know it exists. So this basically means everything. It's this extremely wide-ranging field. And because it's way too complicated to deal with in full detail, we get all kinds of dramatic oversimplifications and less oversimplifications. And studying modern computer graphics and reading the proceedings of SIGGRAPH is sort of like a survey of how to make the world computable, which can be really daunting. It is also an extremely competitive field. Most people that enter programming don't enter because of graphics, but the people that do often are dyed-in-the-wool, true blue believers that nothing matters besides video games or movies. And so it's a space where the pace of innovation is really high, but if you decide you want to be part of that innovation, it's a sprint to keep up. Okay? That doesn't mean there aren't cool things you can do. There are so many things to study, right? Many people are successful here. But it is one of the places where I've most often heard somebody, seen like two or three papers that all make the same advance on the previous art published in the same conference, right? Because three groups were all moving forward at the same time. So it's a challenging field in that sense, but it's a field where if you know anything else, it will come in handy. Have a mild passion for bacteria? Somewhere, somebody wants a better picture of bacteria, right? I don't know who it is, but I know they exist, right? And I know if you can write the paper that says this is how bacteria really exist, and I have this cool movie of how bacteria is coming to antibodies and they die, right? You can make a career out of that, because it's such a huge field. It is also one of the fields where people just give money directly to the field. So when we interview faculty candidates, one of the things we're always supposed to figure out is, do they get grants? Does somebody that cares believe their work is worth money? And graphics is one of those rare places where their grants come from industry primarily rather than the government, because there's somebody that can monetize directly what they do. And so it's this space where people want it right now, and you make it, and you can get money right now. But somebody else also made it too. And so it's, I don't know, it's not a predictably stable place. We have touched on just the tiniest surface of the things we touched about, and only the tiniest random sample of the things we could talk about. But I hope, as a result of this, you've got a sense of how you could dive in further. And if you decided, ugh, graphics, I hope you've also got a sense of how you could dive in further to other spaces. Because although this is a particular discipline, each of the other disciplines, there's some similar kind of develop and build upon it, dive into discipline X, pull out the parts we want, ignore the rest, turn things into linear algebra. That's how computing works, right? So hopefully it's been useful. I've had fun teaching you all, and I will see you for the final.